Hi, I'm Jim Wallace, and this is Jim Wallace in Conversation. In a small, dark church at midnight, on New Year's Eve in Washington, D.C., a young woman rose to greet the congregation. She did not share their Christian faith, but she was there to share her prayers for America. And the way she spoke about the darkness many were feeling was transforming. Her speech has now been seen by some 20 million people. And today in our program, I'll talk to that young speaker, the Sikh filmmaker and activist, Valerie Kaur, about how she sees faith and justice coming together to renew America in what she calls revolutionary love. Welcome, Valerie.
I'm so delighted to be with you, Jim. Thank you.
You said something that really got my attention, and that's what I want to talk about today. You said, the way we make change is just as important as the change we make. I love that. This show is about what I call the hunger for justice and the hunger for spirituality, the two great hungers in the world today, and how they are deeply connected. And you gave a speech that spoke to both of these themes. It took place at midnight on welcoming in the new year, an African-American church, a few hundred people, and that speech shot around the world on the internet like a rocket. It's been seen, I'm told, by 20 million people. So I want to play a little of that to start and have our listeners get a sense of how you set the stage for that speech.
On Christmas Eve, 103 years ago, my grandfather waited in a dark and dank cell. He sailed by steamship across the Pacific Ocean from India to America, leaving behind colonial rule. But when he landed on American shores, immigration officials saw his dark skin, his tall turban worn as part of his Sikh faith, and saw him not as a brother, but as foreign, as suspect, threw him behind bars where he languished for months. Until a single man, a white man, a lawyer named Henry Marshall, filed a writ of habeas corpus that released him Christmas Eve, 1913.
So, Valerie, your grandfather came 100 years ago in the dramatic way you described. Can you pick up the story from there and where he went and what he became?
Yes, my grandfather, Kehar Singh, settled in the Central Valley of California. He was one of several thousand of the very first pioneers who had come to the United States from India. And it was a time when people who were Asian, South Asian, weren't allowed to become citizens, weren't allowed to own land, weren't allowed to come back to the country if they ever left. And yet that did not stop my grandfather from making a life and making a future. And so when his neighbors were rounded up and taken to concentration camps, because that's what they were, Japanese-American neighbors incarcerated during World War II, he must have remembered the kindness and generosity and really the ethic of love that he received from Henry Marshall, the lawyer who set him free. He was one of the few who hitched his horse and buggy and traveled to Poston, Arizona to visit them in the camps. He looked after their farms so that they would have a home to return to. He really, you know, the stories I grew up listening to really taught me what it meant to be an American. And so I wanted to be an American in the same way my grandfather was.
So he, a brown-skinned man in a turban, became a farmer in California. And then he responded by treating his neighbors when they got in trouble in the same kind of way. It must have been a powerful thing to hear that story.
You know, when I grew up as a little girl, we had a petrified rock sitting on our fireplace my entire childhood. And I learned that that was the rock that my grandfather had brought back from Arizona. And so it served as a constant reminder that our liberation, that our freedom, that our flourishing as a people were bound up with that of our neighbors. And so I learned at a young age that the only way that we expand this notion of who counts as American, who is seen as American, who is treated as American in this country, is if we fight for every single one of us.
4 days after September 11th, something terrible happened that became very personal to you and your family?
I remember watching the towers fall over and over between an image of a turbaned and bearded man, Osama bin Laden. It dawned on me that our nation's new enemy now looked like my family, looked like my grandfather. Within moments, we heard news of hate crimes across the country. And on September 15th, Balbir Singh Sodhi, a turbaned Sikh man, was standing in front of his gas station when a truck reeled around the corner, a gun leaned out the window and fired. He was the first of dozens of people killed in hate crimes in the aftermath of September 11th. And yet his story, their stories, barely made the evening news. Balbir Singh Sodhi was a man my family knew, a man I considered an uncle, and so I found myself swept up in so much pain and so much grief and so much confusion. I was 20 years old. I remember running to my bedroom to hide. I didn't want to face my place in this country as an American. I didn't want to face my place in this country as a Sikh whose community was suddenly under attack. And yet I remember hearing the words of my grandfather coursing through me, "That divana lagi pad bram shanai," the hot winds cannot touch you. I grabbed my camera, I got in my car, and I drove into what felt like a whirlwind, what felt like the hot winds. And I went to Phoenix, I went from city to city, from community to community, and I captured the stories of hate violence against Sikh Americans and others who were swept up in the violence. And that film became Divided We Fall. And it pains me that all these years later, we thought we were making a film that was capturing a brief season of madness in the country's history. And yet the truth is, we are still living under the long shadow of September 11th. And so that film, its stories are relevant now more than ever.
So with your weapons, your law degree and your filmmaker camera, you took on all of this. And then you and your husband have a son, a brown-skinned boy that you're raising in this whole environment of fear and rage, which brings your story up to date to now, you as a mom. Now, in that speech that just took off around the world, you're speaking as a mother very powerfully to this political moment of darkness that we find ourselves in. Let's hear what you said about that.
Yes, Rabbi. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The future is dark. On this New Year's Eve, this watch night, I close my eyes and I see the darkness of my grandfather's cell. And I can feel the spirit of ever-rising optimism in the Sikh tradition, Chardikala, within him. And so the mother in me asks, what if? What if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our America... What if our America is not dead, but a country that is waiting to be born? What if the story of America is one long labor? What if all of our grandfathers and grandmothers are standing behind us now, those who survived occupation and genocide, slavery and Jim Crow, detentions and political assault? What if they're whispering in our ear today, tonight, you are brave? What if this is our nation's great transition? What does the midwife tell us to do? Breathe, and then, because if we don't push, we will die. If we don't push, our nation will die. Tonight, we will breathe. Tomorrow, we will labor in love, through love, and your revolutionary love is the magic we will show our children. Vai Guru Ji Ka Khalsa, Vai Guru Ji Ki Fateh.
From the darkness of the tomb to the darkness of the womb. What a turn. I feel people telling me, Valerie, the darkness they're feeling every day, the darkness of this moment people are feeling. But you're saying this could be a time of rebirthing. Say more about that.
I feel that darkness too, Jim. Everything hurts. During the election season and then after the election and since the inauguration, my community stands in harm's way Every few days we hear news about the next hate crime. And now as a mother to a son who's a brown boy who's keeping his hair long, who may wear a turban one day as part of his faith, I know that I'm giving him a nation that is more dangerous than the one that I was given. Everything is so dark for me personally and for me as an activist. I have never hurt as much as I have been hurting since I was in labor. I wanted to do an unmedicated labor. I thought I would meditate my way through it. And of course, every contraction felt like a wave. It felt like dying. It felt like drowning. There was very little conception that what I was experiencing was at all connected to a baby. It was very hard for me to breathe or to push. And the only way I did it was because my mother's hand was on my head, whispering in my ear, "You are brave." I remember the midwife said she could see the head, but all I could feel was a ring of fire. And I turned to my mother and I said, "I can't, you know, I can't, it hurts too much, I can't." And she started whispering a prayer that my grandfather had taught us when I was little. When she recited this prayer, this ancient Sikh prayer, I saw my grandmother behind my mother and her mother behind her. And her mother behind her, and this long line of women who had birthed me, stretching on into infinity. That's the only way I could take a breath, and that's the only way I could push into the fire, right? Push into the pain. And my son was born. And so post-election, I realized I couldn't breathe. I was having a hard time breathing on my own. And the only way I could do it was to close my eyes and to remember my grandmothers and my grandfather standing behind me and then stretching back to King and Gandhi and Mandela and Chavez and Day and every person who has risen up to fight for social justice, all those unnamed peoples who have survived generations of atrocity and yet have still risen up, and to feel their love behind me was the only way I have been able to stand up each day and face the news, face the world, and do the work. So breathing, labored breathing is a very particular kind of breathing. You can't do it alone. You need to take the hand of the person next to you. You need to breathe with them, and you need to feel all of the ancestors and their courage flowing through you. And that's what I think we need to do right now for our country. Because Jim, it was a question. You know, I said, what if? What if this is not the darkness of the tomb? What if it is the darkness of the womb? It is a choice that we have to make. If we don't push, I say, if we don't push, we will die. If we don't push, our nation will die. So I'm serious about the stakes. This is not some kind of manufactured hope. This is a dark moment. But I do believe the rising up that we are seeing right now, I have not seen in my lifetime. People of all different colors and faiths and backgrounds standing together in ways I have never seen before. Millions of people awakened in ways I've never seen before. I think that if we are breathing together and if we are pushing together, it is possible to birth a new future. And that's why I believe that revolutionary love is the call of our times. Revolutionary love for others, our opponents, but also ourselves. And that comes from the experience of being a mother, but I think it's this universal call and the moment that we are facing.
Well, you say that. You say revolutionary love, and here's how you say it. When we practice love in the face of fear or rage, then we can transform an encounter, a relationship, a culture, or a country. Our love becomes revolutionary. What's the Sikh foundation for this?
The origin story of my faith. Love is the heart beating at the center. So 500 years ago, a man named Nanak, distraught by the violence of his age, of his time, disappeared by this river for 3 days in Sultanpur in modern-day Punjab. People think him a dead man. People think him a drowned man. But he emerges on the third day, rebirthed, right? Birthed anew, with a vision of oneness on his lips, Ik Onkar. He taught that we are one. He taught that within each of us is a voice that lives and struggles and wants and dies only for itself. It's called Home, Home, H-A-U-M-A-I, the voice that literally names itself against others, the I that names itself. And when we quiet that voice, then something marvelous happens. We fall in love. And when we are in love, we see with new eyes. I see no stranger, says Nanak. I see no enemy. That means that we are called to look upon the faces of those who do not look like us and say, brother, sister, I see you. I choose to love you. And therefore, I will fight for you when you are in harm's way. And so the Sikh faith as a faith of love became a faith of revolutionary love, because Nanak says, if you want to play the game of love with me, step forth with your head on your hand. The path of love is dangerous. The path of love is not safe. It's not easy, because if you are in harm's way, then I am called not by duty, not by obligation, not by this seeking of something in return. I am called by love to stand up for you. And so we as Sikhs became a warrior people, sword and shield in our hands, fighting the Mughal Empire, fighting against religious persecution. Our history is strung with stories of battles and martyrdom. And these are the stories that have come down to us. So as a little brown girl growing up in California in the 80s, what did these stories mean to me? I wanted to be a great warrior one day, but I had no idea what that meant until I realized we do not need literal weapons to fight for justice today. My film camera became my sword. My law degree became my shield. And it's possible, I think, for every one of us to look at the swords that are available to us, our megaphones, our pens, our doctor's scalpel, our artist's brush, and imagine ways that we may fight for one another through love, with love. And so the call to revolutionary love is inspired by my Sikh faith, but I believe it is a secular ethic. It is a moral imperative that can be animated by all of our various different faith and wisdom traditions.
I want our listeners to know that you're a person talking about this revolutionary love as a lawyer and an activist and a filmmaker. You're talking about the real world. You're saying policy isn't going to change enough by itself. Love is the only force that can change us. A lot of people would look at this kind of talk and say, but evil is real. Evil is real, and we have to account for evil. So how does this call for love turn into a kind of ethic of universal love that deals with evil in a real way?
I was skeptical of love, too. Love was something I could cherish and talk about inside of my faith. But as a lawyer, I was trained to be suspicious of love. For in this country, love has been captured by Hallmark. Love is a sentimental emotion, too sentimental, too anemic, too fickle to be a political force. I had always felt that way up until about a year ago when this election season brought with it an explosion of hate violence. And I fell into a moment of crisis, realizing that for a generation of activism had not prevented what the Southern Poverty Law Center calls an era of enormous rage for my son or his generation. At the time, I was working at Stanford Law School on digital rights as civil rights. I had a moment of deep existential crisis. I left my job and I spent some time thinking deeply as a lawyer, right? What has actually created change for the communities I have served? And Jim, it was never my op-ed. It was never our film or our lawsuit. These things were essential for any movement, but it never depended on them. It always came down to a surprising question. Is love present here? When people in the face of massacre or crisis received love from the broader community, it emboldened them to respond in loving and creative ways. In the absence of that, nothing changed. In fact, I saw people withdraw, repeat cycles of violence. Hannah Arendt says, isolation breeds tyranny. Isolation breeds tyranny. I, in my life, have never encountered evil as evil. I have only encountered hurting people who then go on to hurt people. And so the only antidote to isolation is the ethic of love. The last time that love was central in American political discourse was during the civil rights era, when faith leaders like Dr. King made love a form of social justice. Since then, we've sidelined it along with the language of faith. I think it's really time. I think it's time to go back to Gandhi, King, Mandela, Chavez, and our faith traditions and lift up the language of love, not as an Abrahamic concept or a Christian concept, but a secular ethic, a moral imperative that is inspired by our traditions, but is offered up in a new way for a new age, for a new time. Even in the political arena, it has the power to transform I have witnessed it. I have practiced it. And I believe it's possible for all of us to take it up as a way to labor. Labor is painful. Labor requires pain and love. So the only way we'll be able to birth a new future is if we take up this ethic together and we breathe and push and breathe and push through love.
So let's do that right here for a moment, the Christian and Sikh traditions here. And you mentioned King. And in my Christian tradition, love had to go through a cross. It went to a cross. Love had to suffer. And King made that clear. There was always a willingness in King to suffer and finally to die for that love. It wasn't just listening to King and finally agreeing with his eloquent rhetoric. He was willing to go to the cross, and Jesus goes to a cross, and then the resurrection is a validation, a vindication of that kind of love, that finally violence and wealth and power won't have the last word. But in our Christian tradition, love has to be willing to suffer, to go to a cross, and then the power of it comes from the suffering. How does that relate to the Sikh tradition? Love, suffering, and change.
It makes me think of the story of the very first woman warrior.
Hmm.
Her name was Mai Bako. The story goes, in 1705, there were 40 soldiers who abandoned their post during a great battle. They returned to the village, and this village woman turned to them, and she said, "You will not abandon the flames. You will not abandon the battlefield. You will return to the fire, and I will lead you." She mounts a horse, she dons a turban, and with sword in her hand and fire in her eyes, she takes them where no one else would go, but she becomes the one she is waiting for. I have thought of my Bago story a lot since the election, because I think each of us may feel the impulse to desert, right? We know what it feels like to be among the 40 deserters who says, actually, the suffering is too painful. The fires burn too high. The flames are too hot. But it's also an opportunity for the warrior inside of each of us to take the deserter's hand and lead her back into the flames. Because Christ had to go to the cross willingly, and that took bravery. Surrender to the fight requires courage that one may not even know one has unless one faces it.
You often talk about going into the flames. I've heard you say that before. That's the key, it seems. In other words, love doesn't win by sitting on the edges of the flames. Unless you walk into the flames, it doesn't really have that kind of power. And that's how this ethic of love becomes revolutionary. That's what I hear you saying. They're walking into the flames. How do we help each other do that?
There are those of us who are inoculated enough by our privilege that we have the option of sitting on the sidelines right now. We have the option of retreating into our privilege, however it manifests for us because of our race or our socioeconomic background or where we live. But there are those of us who are already in the flames. My community, the Sikh community, the Muslim community, the Black community, undocumented community, refugees, we are already in the fire. And the only way we can walk through these flames is if we're not alone, is if we take one another's hands and if we lead with love. And so this is the time to hear the call for those people who are allies, who are white folks, who are Christian folks, who are middle class folks, who are wondering what the role is in their fight or whether they are authorized enough to go and show up with us. We need you. We can't do it without you. And don't do it out of duty. Don't do it out of obligation. Don't do it because you want something else in return, because we will not last that way. If you do it because of love, because you are called by the ethic of love to draw close to the flames, to draw close to those who are suffering and hear our stories, is the only way to practice love is to draw close to one another, close enough to hear each other's stories, to ask of one another, who are you? What is at stake for you? What is my role in your flourishing? What is your role in mine? If we ask those questions in our hearts, if we listen to one another's stories, then it becomes easy to respond. It becomes spontaneous ethical action. We know what to do. We show up at LAX, at the airports across the country when refugees are detained, because we know the stories. We are called to the streets. That's all we have to do, is face the flames, go close to the people who are suffering, listen, and then let love lead you.
And unless we let love lead us into the flames, it doesn't transform us. And there is no resurrection. There is no new life. So there's a story of forgiveness that you tell. This is about how we treat our opponents that I was very moved by. This friend of your family, this man you call your uncle, who was killed on September the 15th, he was killed, murdered by someone who's in prison, I guess now for 15 years or a long time. And you have reached out to him and talked to him. That was a powerful story. Tell us about that desire to act in forgiveness toward the murderer of this dear uncle of yours.
Every year at the gas station where Balbir Singh Sodhi was murdered, the family and community gather. It is an ordinary Chevron gas station that you would just drive by without giving it a second thought outside of Phoenix in Arizona. But if you look closely, at the very corner of this gas station is a small memorial, is a small plaque honoring all those who were killed on 9/11 and all those killed in its aftermath. It was erected in the very spot where he bled to death. I have returned to this spot countless times since I was 20, since September 11th. I sit by that memorial and I close my eyes and I renew my vow to fight in hard times. And so last September, on the 15-year anniversary of his murder, I returned to Phoenix with the Sodhi family. And I was standing in front of the memorial with Rana Sodhi, his younger brother, who has been championing love and forgiveness for 15 years, speaking his brother's story to any audience who would hear it. And Rana Sodhi, this beautiful man of light and wisdom and courage, turns to me during this election season, right, and says, "Nothing has changed." And I swallow hard, and we put down red roses on his grave and candles. And I turned to Rana and I said, "Well, who is the one person we have not yet tried to love?" The next morning, Rana Sodhi and I call Frank Roque, Balbir Uncle's murderer, in prison. The last time we had heard anything from him was at the trial when he said that he admitted to saying that he was going to kill all those terrorists and their children too. He had no remorse, no regret. As the number was dialing to the prison, I thought, I hope I'm not crazy for trying this. And in the beginning, I thought I was. In the beginning, I hear Frank say, "Yes, I'm sorry for all the people who were killed on September 15th and after, but I'm also sorry for all those who were killed on 9/11. He shows no regret. He takes no ownership. And I start to get angry. I start to feel shame, because all this time I'm thinking and talking and preaching about revolutionary love. And of course, there are limits to love. You do not call your uncle's murderer to try to forgive him. But Rana Sodhi, who's listening, right, listening so closely to Frank's story, listening, says, "Frank, this is the first time I have ever heard you say you were sorry." So he takes a step toward Frank, and then I hear Frank takes a step toward Rana. He says, "Yes, I am sorry. I'm sorry for what I did to you and your family. And when I go to heaven to be judged by God, I will ask to see your brother, and I will hug him, and I will ask for his forgiveness." And Rana Sodhi says, "We've already forgiven you." That's when I learned. That's when I learned that forgiveness is not forgetting. We will never forget what Frank Roque did, or what white nationalists are doing now, or even what this president is doing, or what those terrorists did. Not to equate all those atrocities, but oh, all of these players have caused and are causing so much suffering, so much violence. We will never forget. Forgiveness is freedom from hate. Because when we are free from hate, then we can draw close to these stories. We can understand that Frank did what he did out of a sense of unresolved grief, that we as a country don't know how to hold one another's grief so that it doesn't spin out into more violence. That's why we had the election that we had. so many people not knowing how to hold their grief, feeling like their power economically, culturally was diminishing in this country, not seeing a place for themselves in a country that was more diverse than it's ever been before. We need to hold up a vision, a moral vision for a nation that includes every single one of us, that holds every one of us in love, through love, the ethic of love. And this is why I believe, because I've seen it. I have witnessed it. I have felt the transformative power of love. This is why I no longer cringe at the word, because it is the truth that I will now be singing for the rest of my life.
The hunger for justice and the hunger for spirituality. And we will never find justice without the spirituality. And you have just testified to that today. And Valerie, I want to thank you very much for this time together. Bless you.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you for leading the way so that a new generation can walk this path too. I couldn't be doing what I am doing today without you.
The Sikh filmmaker and activist Valerie Kaur. When Valerie Kaur talked about changing the darkness of the tomb to the darkness of the womb, she changed the whole conversation. And the 20 million people who listened to her short reflection on YouTube all felt that. Instead of the darkness and even despair millions of Americans felt after the election, a woman who had recently given birth to her first son saw that darkness differently. Perhaps the darkness we are experiencing now is necessary for the literal birthing of a new nation. Perhaps it wasn't going to be just slow and steady progress toward a new multicultural country, but something we would have to breathe and push for. As Valerie reminds us, the midwives tell mothers in labor, the most important political fact in America, and one that shapes virtually all of our other issues, is that by 2050, the U.S. will no longer be a white majority nation. Instead, we are becoming a majority of minorities. Such a transformation doesn't come easily or without breathing and pushing. And that's what Valerie's powerful image reminded us of, to see our coming diversity as the best gift of American history, to see it that way rather than as the greatest threat, is the spiritual question before us right now. Valerie Kaur reminds us that it is often women who will lead the way, take the risks, and bear the pain of what new birth requires. Call them the midwives of hope. Time and time again, it has been women and mothers who have moved the conscience of a nation. The mothers of the disappeared in Latin America did that. The mothers of the movement of young men and women of color who've died at the hands of law enforcement, they did that too. Today, many young women are leaders in movements like Black Lives Matter, movements growing and deepening all over the country. We do need to resist what is wrong and dangerous. We really do. But it may be the birthing of the new democracy we aspire to that will most shape the future, and women will figure centrally in all of that. Valerie Kaur is one of the many people that give me hope for that rebirthing. Our program is produced by Kitty Isley and engineered by Paul Woody Woodhall, with help today from Jamie Benson. The executive producer is Lee Hernandez. Thanks to Eric Newsom at Audible. I'm Jim Wallace. Join me again here next time for Jim Wallace in Conversation. I hope you come back.